As I mentioned on Monday, a student left a question for me that he had written out. I meant to get to it on Wednesday, but the time flew by and I didn't. I ought to answer it. It's a serious question, and before I resume our discussion and the order in which we've been following, I'd like to dispose of the question. The student wrote, "I believe the dichotomy you are making between the Hebraic and Greek spirit does not give proper justice to the complexity of human nature. Nietzsche, in The Birth of Tragedy, demonstrates the origins of Greek tragedy from religious ceremonies of a dark and mysterious nature. For many Greeks, the religious ritual of most gripping significance were these mysteries. In fact, Greek religion was deeper and more shrouded than you would have us believe." Now let me see if I could answer it. Others of you may have felt the same. Let me make one thing clear. In my discussion, I was contrasting the style of Homer and the style of the Bible. And even if one assimilates to the Homeric style with many allowances, many modifications, Plato and other writings of the Greeks, there's still the contrast in style between the Bible on the one hand and Greek literature in general, but particularly Homer on the other hand. The Greeks certainly felt the mystery of nature. But this was one of the essential differences between biblical and Greek civilizations, ways of thought, was that the Greeks tried to dissipate the mystery of nature. They tried to penetrate into it, and they tried to remove the mystery through the rational process. I gave you the example starting with Thales, Empedocles, Democritus, and so on. We don't have that phenomenon at all in biblical thought. The biblical style of thought and feeling was to leave much in an unexplored and an unpenetrated and an unexpressed darkness, so that a sense of awesome mystery shrouded human existence and the operations of the world generally, of the universe generally. For who could begin to know, if you start with the basic assumptions, who could begin to know or to understand the mind of an omniscient, omnipotent God who created the universe? God, who was the ruler of the universe and the judge of the universe, particularly of mankind. So that from the standpoint of the very basic premises, a lot had to be left untouched, unknown. Whatever explanation there was for any one thing was an explanation which was surrounded by a sea of the unknown, the unexplored. This is not the feeling that one gets from Greek literature, Greek thought. There was a contrast, of course, fundamental, between the biblical God and the Greek gods. The Greek gods were, in a manner of speaking, large human beings. They had the passions of human beings. They went through many of the actions that human beings go through. They had wives, women. The goddesses had husbands. They had children. They had their quarrels. They had their parties, their celebrations. And they had their partialities and their animosities in the human world. Hector, Achilles, Odysseus,
Or each one had a god or a goddess who looked after his interests, and other gods and goddesses who were in conflict with that god or goddess, so that there were always these tensions among them. It's a kind of a drama that went on among the gods and goddesses, which in a way was reflected in what happened among men. Now, in addition to that, in later time, the Greeks had their mystery religions. That's another story. They were not characteristic of the Greek way of life and the Greek way of thought. The Greek mystery religions had their influence, but they had their influence later. One way of dealing with Socrates and Plato, and particularly with the concept of the soul, which we will consider in due time, is to try to trace it back through Pythagorean and other mystery cults. And if these cults had an influence, it was only through the mainstream of going through Socrates and Plato, and from them into Stoicism, rather than an original line which the mystery religions themselves developed. There was, and this, of course, is, I think, the knob of the understanding of Nietzsche's great contribution. This was the first book of Nietzsche's. He wrote it when he was, I think, only 23 or 24 years of age at the time. The importance of The Birth of Tragedy is hard to describe, because it's a very stimulating document. But what is the basis for Nietzsche's insight into the Apollonian and the Dionysian trends in Greek feeling and thought is really the conflict between the rational and the irrational. It's not between the clearly defined, the rational process, and the mysterious. But there was an irrational element in the Greeks. And the great merit of Nietzsche is that he brought it out, and he was a pioneer in that respect, and he himself couldn't calculate the importance of it. But in more recent time, in our own day, people like Dodd and others have developed that aspect of Greek life, the irrational, which had hardly been known, certainly hardly been dealt with by intellectual historians, by the historians of Greek philosophy. If you take any textbook of Greek philosophy, you will not find even now this element treated. The irrational in the Greeks did not have the impact on Western civilization which would merit our devoting time and effort to it. Greek civilization had a tremendous impact on the development of Western culture, but it was not that aspect which accomplished that influence. So I'm glad the student asked the question. It's a point perhaps that I should have made. Now, if I may go back to where we left off and try to conclude this part of our discussion. We were discussing Job, and I was trying to provide you with what I consider to be an explanation in terms of some premises that seem to me and to others to be fundamental in biblical conception. And that was the point which we reached at the end of the hour, that Job became reconciled to what on the level of appearance seemed to be a shattering contradiction which the human being could hardly face. And that was, as I put it to you, that if God is powerful and if God is just, then how can one reconcile the existence of the obvious injustices that exist in the world, where the righteous suffer and the evil flourish, not consistently, but enough to be able to characterize life from the standpoint of morality, perhaps as an absurdity. So the resolution was that the same God who's the creator, who made nature, made the laws of nature, we may not understand them. We know so very little about the lion, the life of the lion, the life of the hippopotamus, the sky, the astral phenomena, the sun, the stars, the moon. We know so little about anything that God has created. And yet we do know and do believe that there is order in the universe, that the laws of God laid down for nature are operative. And so he must be reconciled with the fact that the same God who laid down the moral laws for man are operative in the universe, whether we understand the operation or not. Now let me go on from there. The power of evil is, of course, apparent. And it's apparent in the Bible from the very beginning, where Cain kills Abel. Abel was killed. He wasn't evil. He was the victim of a terrible crime, a terrible sin. Jezebel, in fact, did kill Naboth. And one could multiply these instances without end. The Bible reflects this phenomenon. To give you a typical example outside of Job, one of the Psalms, Psalm 10, this is so clearly stated. Why dost thou stand afar off, O Lord? Why dost thou hide thyself in times of trouble? In arrogance, the wicked hotly pursue the poor. Let them be caught in the schemes which they have devised. Now, there's no denial. The wicked do pursue the poor. The poor get terribly hurt. For the wicked boasts of the desires of his heart. And the man greedy for gain curses and renounces the Lord. In the pride of his countenance, the wicked does not seek the Lord. All his thoughts are, there is no God. Yet his ways prosper at all times. Thy judgments are on high, out of his sight. As for all his foes, as the wicked man, he puffs at them. He thinks in his heart, I shall not be moved. Throughout all generations, I shall not meet adversity. His mouth is filled with cursing and deceit and oppression. Under his tongue are mischief and iniquity. He sits in the ambush in the villages and hiding places. He murders the innocent. And so on and so on. I can give you many, many more examples. The innocent do get murdered. There's no denial of that fact. Now, in the face of evil, the biblical man tries to respond. And he tries to respond in several different ways. First, he hopes that the time will come when evil will be defeated and righteousness will be vindicated. To the naked eye, when the whole world will see, there's a lot in the Bible about that, and it's tied in eventually with the messianic era. That's one aspect. And even before the messianic strand gets into biblical thought, there's the great hope of the human heart that if God would only use his power and crush the wicked, and so the one could no longer say that the wicked flourish. but only that the righteous flourish. That's one aspect, one way. And many of the prayers, many of the psalms end up this way. They start out with the situation as I've given it to you. The same psalm, Psalm 10, it goes on later. Arise, O Lord, O God, lift up thy hand. Forget not the afflicted. Why does the wicked renounce God? Why do you let him get away with it? Show your power. All right, that's one aspect. It's very familiar to all of us. The second is that the biblical man moves away from the sphere of life as one sees it. And he moves to another realm, which to him is the realm of reality, in which the relationship, the intimate relationship between man and God, is the justification for righteousness. That relationship in itself becomes the vindication of the righteousness, of righteousness and of God. Psalm 15 is a typical example. O Lord, who shall sojourn in thy tent? Who shall dwell on thy holy hill? This is, of course, figurative language. As who will live in your house? Who will be intimate with you? He who walks blamelessly and does what is right, speaks truth from his heart, does not slander with his tongue, does no evil to his friend, nor takes up a reproach against his neighbor, in whose eyes a reprobate is despised, but who honors those who fear the Lord, who swears to his own hurt and does not change, who does not put out his money at interest, and does not take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things shall never be moved. He doesn't mean he shall never be moved in that an assassin may not catch up with him, a murderer, he may be mugged, he may be killed. It doesn't mean that. It means that on that level of his relationship with God, nobody can reach that. Nobody can disturb that. Another would be Psalm 56. Be gracious to me, O God, for men trample upon me. Again, there's no denying of the fact. All day long, foes oppress me. My enemies trample upon me all day long, for many fight against me proudly. When I am afraid, I put my trust in thee, in God whose word I praise, in God I trust without a fear. What can flesh do to me? You see how suddenly he transcends his own situation. What can flesh do to me? They may hurt my flesh. They may hurt me very grievously. They may even kill me. But that's not his concern. His real self, where he is in relation to God, that's an impenetrable fortress. No one can reach that. The Sermon on the Mount can be read in the same way. There's several different versions of the Sermon on the Mount in the New Testament. I take Matthew's, in chapter 5 of Matthew. Seeing the crowds, he, that is Jesus, went up on the mountain, and when he sat down, his disciples came to him. Traditionally, the mountain is a very low hill. We wouldn't call it a mountain. It's between Tiberias and Safed in Galilee. There's a monastery on the top. Anybody who's traveled there, it's pointed out to him that traditionally is the place where the Sermon on the Mount took place, and it very well may have been the place. So seeing the crowds, he went up, and when he sat down, his disciples came to him, and the teacher in ancient Israel, and this is still the tradition, sits down. He doesn't stand the way we do. This is a Western invention, but among them, he sat and he spoke. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. And then two more of the Beatitudes. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Let me say something about that. It takes only a minute, if that, to read these Beatitudes. But of course, this isn't the way Jesus uttered them. The traditional teacher may have taken hours. They had plenty of time. Their tempo was quite different from what ours is, to have expressed these thoughts, these simple sentences. Even today, I've myself seen how a teacher, a rabbi, and Jesus was referred to as a master or as a rabbi, that's the Hebrew word for it. And some of the translations into English use that term, addressing him that, because it means only teacher, master. He sits at the head of a table, his disciples sit around the table, and they ask the teacher to teach them. And they may sit quietly for a long time before he will say a word. It may take a half an hour, longer. And then when the Spirit moves him and he feels he's ready, he may say, as Jesus said, Blessed are the poor in spirit, and the words in spirit, scholars think generally is a gloss. It's been inserted by some editor at some point that Jesus might have said, Blessed are the poor, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And it may take another half hour before he would come to the second of the Beatitudes. In the meantime, his disciples would repeat what he said. And this is how, of course, we know what he said. There were no books at the time in the sense in which we have books. The people remembered. They used their memory. And maybe for the next 15, 20 minutes, the disciples would repeat what he said. We try to understand it. We try to absorb the spirit in which the sentence was expressed. And then they would never forget. They would in turn tell others. So a tradition developed. And years later, there's no difficulty about making a record of the sayings of Jesus. I mean, this is typical of the procedure. Now, blessed, in the Hebrew, it means how happy. Ashrei would be the Hebrew word. The Greek would be the equivalent of that. And what does it mean? It doesn't mean happy, I'm listening, you know, to rock music, and I'm all eager to have a drink and holla whoopee and do things of this kind. It's not a New Year's Eve party. It's not happiness in that sense. It means he's talking about the poor here. He's talking about the meek who get hurt constantly. He talks about the wretched people, the hapless people, people who get wounded at every turn of their lives. And yet he says, blessed are they. How happy are they? Now, it means that he has moved from the realm of appearance to another realm, which of course to him is the realm of reality. It means though I may appear to the eyes of men using their eyes of flesh to be miserable, to be wretched, to be poor, even to be a criminal, But before God, I am innocent. God knows I am innocent. And therefore, I am happy. I couldn't be happy if I did not feel that way. I am now in his kingdom. I don't have to be promised anything to come. Although there is the promise too. I'll mention that and explain that in a few minutes. But now, I am in one kingdom where evil may dominate. But at the same time, much more important to me, I am now in God's kingdom. I am already in that land, in the promised land. That's the promised land. As he's trying to describe here a temper of mind, a temper of the soul, and not a physical condition. The physical condition is nothing but misery. But the man's temper of soul, that's another matter. He can say he is happy. He is blessed. The Beatitudes then state who is blessed, who is happy in God's sight, or those who are blessed as they see themselves with the eyes of faith in God and stand in a relation to God's justice and God's love. The very first of the Psalms, it opens with the word blessed. Psalm number 1, blessed is the man. It's the same word as used in the Beatitudes. Now, who is blessed? Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. He is like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither. In all that he does, he prospers. In all that he does, it doesn't mean in the world of shops and factories, and banks. It doesn't mean that at all. In that world, he may be at the very opposite end of what is described. But in terms of the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God, the rulership of God, and the law of God, he is blessed. Yes? I just said to you, happy. It's a temper of mind. A sense, how can one describe it? It doesn't mean, as I said, happy in the conventional sense of being in a what people would describe as a happy situation. It doesn't mean. It means a state of soul, a state of mind. Oh, we use the word peace of mind, peace of soul. There are circumlocutions. If you don't sense it, I don't see how it's possible to define it. But I think you can sense what it means. A sense of intimate satisfaction. Let me give you some examples. Socrates, from another civilization, Socrates in prison considered himself blessed. He was about to take the cup of hemlock, as you will see, we'll come to that, which the warden of the prison in Athens was going to give him. He was to be executed. But there wasn't the slightest intimation in the demeanor of Socrates that he was anything but in a state of euphoria. He was happy. Loved the law of justice, which to him was being frustrated by the British government and by the Indian people themselves. And the only way he could bear witness to that principle was to go to prison, to do things which would end up in his going to prison, and he knew that. But there was every manifestation of a man who felt himself to be blessed, to be happy. There are many examples that one could cite of this kind of a feeling. Jesus on the cross comes readily to mind, but there are some problems with respect to Jesus on the cross, which we'll come to later, where scholars have contrasted Socrates with the cup of hemlock and Jesus on the cross. But that's a matter for discussion. But certainly one interpretation of Jesus on the cross, even from the human point of view, forgetting everything else, is that he was a man who was blessed at that moment, even though he was being crucified. Paul and Peter were both put to death by the Romans. This was during the days of Nero's persecution, put to death in an infamous kind of way, if one can accept some of the traditions that have come down to us with respect to the end that they suffered. But each of them knew more or less how his end would come, but they certainly thought of themselves as happy, as blessed, and even at the moment of execution. Let me try to discuss in this context Ecclesiastes, which offers some problems. And I think that I can help you from this point of view in the same way in which we discussed the book of Job. On the level of appearances, there is no doubt, as the book of Ecclesiastes portrays it, there is no doubt that the moral law is nothing more than foolishness. All life is vanity. All life is absurd. It's nothingness. In chapter 4, again I saw the oppressions that are practiced under the sun. He saw with his eye, this is the world of appearance, and behold the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors, there was power. And I thought the dead who are already dead more fortunate than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been and has not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. Then I saw that all toil and all skill and work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity and the striving after wind. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. Again, I saw vanity under the sun. A person who has no one, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, "For whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure?" This also is vanity and an unhappy business. Chapter 7, these are passages taken at random. In my vain life I have seen everything. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in his evil doing. It isn't true that evil doesn't always pay. It sometimes does pay. It often does pay. It depends on what the context is in which one considers these matters. Chapter 11, again I saw that under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to the men of skill, but time and chance happen to them all. For man does not know his time, like fish which are taken in an evil net, like birds which are caught in a snare. So the sons of men are snared at an evil time when it suddenly falls upon them. And the net catches all, the evil and the righteous together, and there's no distinction between one and the other. And finally, in chapter 12, remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw nigh, when you will say, I have no pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened, and the clouds return after the rain, and the day when the keepers of the house tremble, and the strong men are bent, and the grinders cease because they are few, and those that look through the windows are dimmed, and the doors on the street are shut, when the sound of the grinding is low, and one rises up at the voice of a bird, and all the daughters of song are brought low. They are afraid also of what is high, and terrors are in the way. The almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags itself along, and desire fails, because man goes to his eternal home, and the mourners go about the streets. Before the silver cord is snapped, or the golden bowl is broken, the pitcher broken at the fountain, the wheel broken at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. Now, it is hardly a pessimistic statement to equal this. The sadness, the sense of tragedy, the sense of futility, all expressed in the concept of vanity, which means nothingness in the Hebrew. It's chaos, it's nothing. Now, taking life on that level, it is all, of course, vain. But this does not mean that man knows God's ways and God's doings as the Lord of history and the judge. There's a sense of mystery that still remains, as Isaiah put it, For as the heavens are high above the earth, so, this is God speaking, the Lord speaking through Isaiah, for as the heavens are high above the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. A great gap between appearance and reality. But, and this is the great, of course, conclusion, it is enough that man knows what God has commanded him, and to know and to do. If God has commanded him what to know and what to do, then that is sufficient for him. And this is the resolution at the end of the book of Ecclesiastes. For the end of the matter is this: all has been heard. Fear God, keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. As there's another realm, God in his own way, his ways, which are quite different from ours. In that relationship, everything gets to be justified, gets to be meaningful. there's a sense of purpose that finally comes through. God has revealed his law. How it works, that's another matter. We don't know. This is the resolution of Job, and it's the resolution of Ecclesiastes, and of the psalmists, and of a great deal else that is in the Bible. But, whether we know it or not, it's there. And that's the hinge on which life becomes possible. Otherwise, the best thing to do would be to commit suicide and end it all as quickly as possible. On that hinge, life has a kind of a fulcrum. It can be maintained. Well, now then, God is revealed in one way. He has revealed his law, his ways, his commandments. He's done it in different ways. He has done it by writing his law on the hearts of man. His conscience, call it what you will. He has also revealed it in his word, through his prophets, through his books. For the Christian, he has also revealed it through the person and the events and the life of Jesus. This was a manifestation of a way. However, God is hidden in that man does not always know or understand how God executes his laws and his judgments. Man may know, because God has revealed them, what the laws and the judgments may be, what God demands of man, that he has revealed. But how God executes the law, that has not always been revealed. Some revelation of it in the Bible, like Joseph interpreting events, Moses interpreting events, Paul interpreting events, but that's a very limited scope, and we haven't had anything like that since. So we don't see the copula, the connection between event and event. But the connection is there. That is the fundamental, implacable belief that the connection is always there, whether we see it or not. Now, there is still another way in which there is a revelation. And I've already mentioned that, but I want to bring it out, and that is that the good man knows that in his relationship with God, the law of God is vindicated. Because he, the believing man, the man of faith, who observes God's commandments, is blessed. He considers himself blessed. By the grace of God, he feels himself happy, despite all appearances, despite all events, which may contradict that phenomenon. That is a form of disclosure. In that relationship, God is not hidden. God is most intimately known. So God is known in several ways, but hidden in many ways. Now, this, of course, is part of the mystery that I discussed or mentioned that one finds in the biblical approach. This sense comes through time and again once one reads the Bible with this understanding. This is the sense in which Paul, for example, asserts that the kingdom of God has already come in Christ, so that the Christian lives in two ages at the same time. He has eternal life now. though he is still subject to death, to persecution, suffering, pain, humiliation, and death. But still, now he has and enjoys eternal life, and therefore is blessed. The now, in the Bible, in many of these contexts, in both Testaments, is one of the most ambiguous of words, because it doesn't mean only a matter of time. It also means the quality of life that one has. Now, in my circumstances, in my setting, in my predicament, me taking myself as I am, it's not a question of the moment, not a question of the time, but it's the question of the quality of the life that one has at that point. Well, there's always a now in the sense of time, and I'm afraid I have to think of that at this point.